Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 287, Not Worth Hellrum, J.B. Robinson, Widow Oosthuizen, the Witwatersrand Gold Grab, and Gardner Williams. First, some admin. Thank you for all the emails of support and ideas received from across the world, particularly Kuen Hartnick, a heritage and archaeology expert who spent time with me recently. Always good to hear from the experts, and we had a long discussion that was fruitful and interesting. With that, onwards, or more accurately, downwards, because we're continuing the saga of early gold mining around the farm Langlachter and the other farms like Turfontein. It's 1886. Hundreds of treasure hunters will descend on the empty veld just south of the Witwatersrand Ridge. A quick note about Kimberley, where the mining magnates were locked in a struggle for supremacy, trying to secure control over the lucrative industry. As you heard last episode, one of these, J.B. Robinson, had run into cash difficulties, but was determined to travel to the Witwatersrand to assess for himself just how much gold could be mined in the main reef discovered by the two Georges. He'd borrowed £20,000 from another Kimberley magnate, Alfred Beit, and along with Beit's partner, Maurice Marcus, launched the Robinson Syndicate with a total capital of £30,000. Then he leapt aboard a stagecoach for the grueling four-day trip between Kimberley and Potchefstroom, where he arrived on the 22nd of July, 1886. The main reef was not an easy vein of rich quartz waiting for a prospector's spade, as you've heard. It was a mysterious sloping and tilted sheet of ancient pyritic conglomerate, the banquet plunging deep into the earth's crust. On the surface, the Highveld in July is icy at night. Sometimes sleet blows when the Antarctic fronts charge up from the south, sweeping that ridge with handfuls of pain. When Robinson pitched up and set about breaking the land to fit his intent, it was a virgin of felt clean and wide open. Within a decade, the land would be utterly transformed by thousands of men forcing their way along the sloping banquet, intent on treasure. In those first 2 years, 1886, 1887, the physical transformation was instantaneous and abrasive. Before the deep shafts, steel headgears, and the vast grey-yellow slime dams reshaped the horizon, the initial impact was a violent tearing of the surface. Tents, wagons, crude timber shanties erased the sparse felt grass within months. The first major transformation was in the watercourses, which were diverted into shallow ditches to wash alluvial gravels, then small, jagged, open-cast trenches that scarred the outcropping rock, and the few native trees were cleared for fuel and raw timber support. They cut into the ridge's natural contours with pick and shovel and black powder, establishing a ruthless industrial grid over what had been pasture land. They brought in an uncompromising obsessive mechanics to the rand, organizing money, importing the heavy stamp batteries from the coast, and laying down the blueprint for total systemic extraction. It was in this El Dorado that Robinson toiled, beginning at Voorgestreesfontein Farm next to Ferreira's camp. First he crushed the conglomerate, then panned it in a nearby stream. It revealed a long tail of gold. Like many others, his first crush had shown that the reef was indeed rich in the scarce material. Robinson traipsed off to Langlachter Farm next door, which was the site of the original discovery made by the two Georges. If you can imagine the scene at Langlachter, about 500 men were busy at this time, digging, crushing, panning, the sound of metal on rock crunching here and there, an exclamation, perhaps a curse. Because of Robinson's nature, he was not necessarily welcome, and many of the diggers were aware that a Kimberley magnate was present, albeit one who was facing bankruptcy back in Griqualand West, as you heard last episode. J.B. Robinson spent a few days crunching through the conglomerate, and he realized swiftly that this reef was like no other. How deep it went was still unknown, but that it was extensive was obvious. Petronella Oosthuizen, the widow, owned portion D of Langlachter Farm, and her fortunes were indeed improving by the day. Robinson made a beeline straight for her house and secured mining and water rights from the widow on July 27th, 1886, paying £450, with an additional option to buy the farm outright for £6,000. In September of that year, the canny investor did just that and also negotiated mining and water rights from the owner of Langlachter Portion B, Anna de Beer Mulder. That cost Robinson £1,000. Robinson later faced criticisms and a whispering campaign. It was rumoured that he had used his charm to seduce Petronella Oosthuizen before negotiating her land away. Petronella was paid the equivalent of 7 million rand for her land. Not a little, but in comparison to its real value, not a lot either. He didn't stop there. Robinson had that war chest of £30,000 and was determined to buy up as much land as he could. He bought 50% of a portion of Vogelstruisfontein, and the other half was owned by prospector Jan Beinkies, as well as 50% of the Turfontein farm next door to Langlachter. Not satisfied, the Kimberley magnate eyed the West Rand, and by the end of October, he had bought five more farms: Randfontein, Eetvalfontein, Redfontein, Middelvlei, and Gemsbokfontein. Then he added a 50% share in Panvlakte Farm, as well as the mineral lease for Waterval Farm. Makes your head spin. As we all know, you need money to make money, and Robinson's syndicate, which included Alfred Beit and Maurice Marcus, now owned more than 12,000 hectares, all achieved within 6 months of wheeling and dealing. He'd spent £26,000 of his £30,000 war chest, and later it would be said that he could scarcely have used the money more profitably. As historian Jay Davenport points out, these properties served as the foundation of a gold mining empire over which he would rule with an iron fist for the next 30 years. Cecil John Rhodes had bankrupted him in Kimberley, securing diamond deals behind his back. He'd squeezed out of the diamond business, but it had taken him only a few months to remake himself on the Witwatersrand front. Of course, at that point, it wasn't clear just how smart his business deals had been. You need faith and shrewdness to succeed, and J.B. Robinson had both characteristics, along with a lashing of determination. Without the last characteristic, nothing else really matters. Dogmatic behavior in the face of naysayers is sometimes foolish, but if your dream is clear and your forecasting skills profound, determination will always bring you to the threshold of wealth, along with that other obvious trait called luck. By snapping up the 12,000 hectares, Robinson was the first wave of Kimberley's rich who would make the journey north to the Witwatersrand. The second wave included Cecil John Rhodes. There's a bit of a myth about his involvement, that he was late to the scene. That is inaccurate. If you cast your memory back to far earlier episodes, I explained how Rhodes had bought the farm Rudeport, right next door to the gold-bearing reefs, more than 10 years earlier. There, it was a purchase based on a whim. A bit of luck, you'd say. Rhodes had been present that day in April 1886 when Kimberley shopkeeper Alexander had crushed conglomerate brought to Kimberley from the Witwatersrand. He had seen the public panning demonstration revealing a gleaming line of gold, and he was impressed, as was J.B. Robinson. It was not that Rhodes wasn't interested. It was just that he was timing his investments on a different schedule. One day, Dr. Hans Sauer appeared at Rhodes' office door in Kimberley, and the De Beers mine owner listened to the physician's tales of wonder. Sauer had been part of the little team that had investigated the Witwatersrand farms, and he too was determined to be part of the next wave of super-rich miners of South Africa. 3 weeks after Robinson's bone-rattling stagecoach trip between Kimberley and the Rand, Rhodes embarked on his own mission to secure part of the farms of gold. Rhodes and his longtime business partner Charles Rudd and Dr. Sauer arrived on the goldfields and spent 4 weeks trekking back and forth along the exposed conglomerate, the main, the secondary reefs. Unlike Robinson, Rhodes hesitated. That much is true. With all the glittering power growing in Kimberley, Rhodes was wary of spending too much of his cash on speculation when he was building his own type of war chest to colonize Southern Africa for the British. That cherished dream that was to get him and the country into so much trouble was in infancy. Cape to Cairo was not a phrase he'd uttered as yet. Many super-rich folks are loath to tinker in spaces they know very little about. Robinson was a gambling man. He'd nothing to lose, after all, forced out of his comfortable life in Kimberley. He was perhaps overconfident on the reef because he had nothing left. Rose and Rudd were canny investors and knew that they knew too little. Gold mining was not a mystery, but it was different to diamond mining. The second main reason why Rudd and Rose hesitated was the scale of this new find. Where Kimberley had been a single pipe of diamonds, a few dozen hectares of land, the gold find was 100 kilometres across. Imagine dragging equipment to this region, toiling by wagon, all the associated costs. Then imagine, too, developing an entirely new technique to mine the conglomerate. For all Rhodes' breadth of imagination in building a colonial vision full of myth and political vagaries, he could not conceive the extent of the wealth contained in this banquet, the conglomerate ore reef. He told Dr. Sauer so much.
I often go and sit on the edge of the De Beers mine, and I look at the blue diamondiferous ground, 1,000 feet down the open workings of the mine, and I reckon up the value of the diamonds in the blue. This I cannot do with your gold reefs.
There were many other respected naysayers who questioned the hidden value of Witwatersrand gold. One was American engineer Gardner Williams. He was the general manager of De Beers and Rhodes's advisor by 1887, and he had ridden to the reef to inspect the findings himself.
If I rode over these reefs in America, he sniffed, I would not even get off my horse to look at them. In my opinion, they are not even worth hell room.
Well, this was a 19th century American idiom, hell room, implying that an object, an idea, or a person had so little value that it was not even worth taking up physical space, the room, in hell. Now, there's a phrase to tinker with. Hell room. As general manager of De Beers Consolidated Mining, Gardner Williams was instituting rapid development. He'd managed to reduce the cost of working the diamonds by increasing the number of hauling and washing machines. Eventually, when De Beers' monopoly was complete in 1888, he would have installed 7 hauling machines, puffing and steaming away day and night. There were 12 additional steam engines driving the washing plant, their rotary action music to the investors' ears, as well as 3 water pumps required to remove the groundwater. Rhodes and his colleagues were well versed in the art of the late Victorian era machinery, without which no gold could be mined on the Witwatersrand in any profitable way. But it was in another area that the massive savings and costs could be achieved, and it involved humans, labour. De Beers had built closed compounds to house all black labour for 3-month short-term contracts, a new kind of labour system that saved money. The workers who trudged across South Africa, some spending 4 months or 5 months or half a year to reach Kimberley, would be thrown into the mines, housed for 3 months, then sent on their way. De Beers dreamed up the scheme, the American Gardner Williams at the forefront of a system that would later become the heartbeat of gold mining. All main diamond companies copied De Beers by 1884. Rhodes's company didn't stop there. De Beers was also an official government convict station, employing prisoners in the sensitive areas of washing floors and sorting operations. This meant they incarcerated the worker/prisoner in a closed space and controlled access to these men, stripping them naked, introducing the humiliating cavity search system. When De Beers tried to introduce the same system for white workers, it precipitated riots in 1883 and 1884, so the company relied on its detective department, who specialized in entrapment. They'd dangle a loose diamond in front of the supervisors, contractors, and the engineers to ensnare their victims foolish enough to try and do hidden deals. The illicit diamond buying craze, which persists to this day, was a form of gambling, in this case gambling freedom for the sake of a single twinkling star. For the black workers, they'd spend almost a week at the end of their 3-month stint, imprisoned where they'd be purged. Diamonds that had been swallowed would be picked out of toilets by meticulous supervisors. Imagine the degradation for both. A short-term contract meant the labourer couldn't build up relationships in Kimberley and easily move hidden diamonds, the illicit diamonds, into the nearby African locations and stores. That saved De Beers and Rhodes from the added cost of a higher loss of his preciousness, while simultaneously creating a long-term culture deployed
by mine owners in South Africa. There were other advantages to moving workers through the system quickly. It decreased drunkenness and brawling between different sets of workers, the pent-up anger that increases between men of different ethnicities and language groups dissipated. De Beers Mining paid a modest dividend in the early years, rising to 20% of shareholder equity by 1886. There was no company tax or even export tariffs levied by the Cape government, where the mining lobby, including Rhodes, resisted all attempts at taxing the rich. We'll come back to this form of business regularly in the series because there is a direct link between how diamonds were mined by labour and gold, and how the owners of the mines were going to try and deliver maximum profit for shareholders, most of whom lived outside of South Africa. We'll end this episode now taking a good hard look at Gardner Williams, an extraordinary man who was to loom large over Rhodes' operations in South Africa, an American who brought his country's distinct form of business from the New World to the ancient world of South Africa. Gardner Frederick Williams was born in Saginaw, Michigan, in March 1842, into a family already shaped by the expansion of the American West. The Williams family belonged to the older generation of American pioneers. Gardner was therefore raised within a world in which mining was neither an abstract science nor a distant occupation. It was part of the material landscape around him. In a decisive move in his youth, in 1858, his father moved the family to California, and Gardner, who was 15, went west. In October 1858, he entered the college school at Oakland, which turned into the University of California later. He graduated in 1865. 10 days after graduation, he went to Freiburg in Saxony in Europe and entered the Berg Academy, the celebrated mining academy that had become one of Europe's principal centers for the scientific training of mining engineers. He studied there for 3 years. In the United States of the 1860s, mining was still strongly associated with practical experience, individual judgment, and knowledge acquired in the field, the grizzled old prospector. Williams received a more systematic education. The mining tradition in Europe included engineering problem solving and geology, surveying, mechanics, metallurgy, and disciplined observation. The young engineer did not move directly into his career. His early working life was mobile and practical. In 1869, he examined salt deposits on Carmen Island in the Gulf of California. 1870, he was the assistant assayer at the United States Mint in San Francisco. The diamond discoveries at Kimberley were already drawing experienced miners from across the world, and the South African fields were beginning to develop an international mining culture in which American practical experience would later become important. Williams himself would not reach South Africa until a decade later. In the meantime, he married Fanny Locke. They had 4 children, 3 daughters and a son. One son, Alpheus Williams, would later enter the same profession as his father and eventually succeed him at De Beers. By 1880, Williams had moved into a more senior and mobile form of professional work at the New York Exploration Company. Here he came across something called the Dutch Flat Hydraulic Mines, and later managed the Spring Valley Hydraulic Mine, the largest hydraulic mine in California. That requires a different kind of engineering judgment, where water is controlled and delivered at enormous force. This experience helped make Williams attractive to investors looking for engineers with knowledge of hard rock and hydraulic mining in Africa. There's a direct link between what Gardner was up to and networks of financiers. While studying at Freiburg, he met students who would end up working with the Exploration Company of London, something in which the Rothschild family had substantial interest. In 1884, the company needed an engineer, and Williams' name came up. Thus, he was summoned to London in April 1884 and sent to the Transvaal. His first South African appointment was at Pilgrim's Rest, where he was manager of gold mines of the Transvaal Gold Exploration and Land Company. This first experience was going to hold him in good stead. The enterprise was unsuccessful. Transport costs too high. Labor almost impossible to secure. The company struggled to establish profitable production. Williams resigned in August 1885, returned home to California, but he had learned core lessons in Pilgrim's Rest. He returned to South Africa in 1886 as the representative of an American mining concern, but now the country's mining industry was changing quickly. Kimberley had already developed into the center of the diamond economy. The Eastern Transvaal was passing through a turbulent cycle of gold discoveries, speculation, and failure. Then the discovery of Witwatersrand gold-bearing reefs in 1886 added an opportunity for Williams, who became one of the American engineers whose professional reputation carried weight in this increasingly international mining economy. While his judgment of the new Witwatersrand field has become one of the better-known episodes because of the skepticism we heard a moment ago, hell room, and history has shown his judgment was wrong, but it's easy to be 2020 in history afterwards, isn't it? His attention was drawn back to Kimberley and Cecil Rhodes. The old system of open pit extraction had reached its limits as the workings became deeper and the structure of the diamond-bearing deposits became more difficult to exploit. Rhodes needed an engineer capable of translating the possibilities of deep mining into an operating system, and he turned to Williams, who obviously had the background for this work. Furthermore, his connections were important because exploration companies linked him to the wider financial and engineering network surrounding Nathaniel Rothschild of America and Alfred Beit of South Africa. So, on May 1, 1887, Williams formally took up the position of general manager of the De Beers Mining Company at Kimberley, ending the formative period and the beginning of the 18 years in which his name became closely associated with the technical development of South African mines. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, tot ziens.